This is the TAM Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do we have a great story behind the book that we're going to be talking about today. Baby X by Kira Peacock. And this is really quite amazing. Sometimes books come out just at the right time when they are sort of in the air, in the atmosphere, people are talking about this subject. And so I'm so happy to welcome you to the program, Kira.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
Wow. Yep. As I said, you know, sometimes these things come just at the right time, and you have all of your books are great. But this one, you know, when I heard the other day about the recent embryo changes in the law and stuff, I right away thought of you, and I think people are going to be thinking a lot about this book because Baby X is a fascinating story. You know, it's a thriller, but it's also so filled with science. I just love it.
Thank you. That's great to hear.
So, you have a degree in journalism from New York University, and also a master's in bioethics, which makes you someone who can really write about this subject. And I think people will find it fascinating. I was excited when I saw that Lee Child gave you a great blurb. I thought that was so good. He says, once again, Peacock gives us a breathless thriller with an ending you totally won't see coming that leaves us wondering if it could be real. Fantastic. Well, those are nice words from Lee Child, aren't they?
Yes, and he's such a wonderful author who really helps up-and-coming authors. He's really well-known in the community for his generosity.
And I think he's hit it with this book because it is breathless. I mean, the subject is so fascinating. So I'll let you lay the premise and tell people about it because it is timely and intriguing. And you've written it around three main characters in three voices, which I like. I like that. So what do you want to tell us about Quinn, Ember, and Lily, and about the premise for this book, which we're saying
sure.
Isn't exactly real yet, but it certainly could be.
So this book is set about 30 years in the future in a world where there's been a massive medical breakthrough about how we have babies in the future. So gone are the days when, you know, you hop into bed and you make a baby. That's seen as reckless and playing the genetic lottery. So no responsible parent would do that anymore. You want to have a little assist from science to make sure that your future kid is going to have health and hopefully future success. So this breakthrough is called IVG. It's actually real and has been proven in mice. It is not in humans yet today. But what it means is that any small sample of cells from someone's body, like a cheek swab or some saliva, could generate enough living cells to be turned into sperm or egg cells. Now think about that for a minute. Anyone of any age or gender, just by giving a cheek swab, could have eggs and sperm, which could then be joined with someone else's to make an embryo. So there's basically much fewer biological constraints on becoming a parent in this world. And while that has led to a lot more people being able to have children, which is a wonderful thing, it also has, of course, some unintended consequences, like celebrities being stalked for their cells if they leave behind a coffee cup with some of their saliva, for example, or a tissue that they've blown their nose into. there's some DNA in it that could be stolen, and a black market that arises for their cells. So I'll just stop there. And
yes. Oh boy. It is. I tell you, it is so close to reality. You know, we say it's in the future, but you know, things just seem to move so fast. It's hard to believe it's already March of 2024. I don't know what happened to those years in between with the pandemic. And then we're saying, I'm not sure, the way science is moving, it could be a lot closer. And the idea of a group of people stalking famous, beautiful people or intelligent, beautiful people, it sounds like it could be happening today.
So interestingly enough, this is a premise that bioethicists have long considered and thought about. I was in graduate school 10 years ago when I first heard about it. It's actually called the celebrity scenario. And so bioethicists have been anticipating that if this kind of breakthrough happens, this will be something that we need to deal with in real life. And when I heard about that 10 years ago in graduate school, I thought, that's got to be a book. So I turned it into one.
Well, I know there are already people who are very careful about not leaving traces of their DNA on cups and things. I mean, there are already people who are very careful about that kind of thing.
Yeah, and actually I saw that at one of those world conferences a few years ago of all the leaders. I think it was at Davos. Some of the world leaders had left behind things like their coffee cups or their knife and fork or napkins, and they were stolen by some unknown person and listed for sale on an eBay-like type of site. And it got some news coverage at the time, which really also kind of inspired the black market in my story, because it's a legal gray area. If somebody leaves behind trash or something gets taken out of the trash, is that someone's property still or not? And it's unclear.
Well, I think according to the police, if you throw things in your garbage and you put your garbage can out in the street, at least in all the television shows, they can just jump on that and find the evidence against you. So it's frightening.
It is. It is, especially when it's DNA and that can't be put back in the bottle. You know, once your DNA is out there and potentially being used against you, you know, it could hold a lot of secrets in it. And that's another theme in the story, that just publishing your DNA sequence could potentially embarrass someone or find biological connections, relatives, predispositions for traits, diseases that are very private information.
So tell us about this group that is after the DNA of famous people or beautiful people or intelligent people. Tell us how you came up with this idea of this group.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really inspired by seeing that event in real life where the world leaders had their DNA targeted, just sort of by this fringe anonymous group that wanted to see if they could list it for sale to the highest bidder. And then in my story, I decided to kind of heighten the stakes by saying, what if that DNA could be turned into sperm or egg, and then eventually these celebrities could be having non-consensual children by people who buy their sperm or egg on the black market? That is quite a scary thought, and that inspired the main storyline in the book.
Well, it is so funny when you think about it. First of all, the premise is interesting, but what people, human beings, don't seem to understand, that you can't just take two beautiful people and, you know, whether it's the old-fashioned way or the new-fashioned way, and combine you know, the DNA and expect that you're going to have somebody beautiful out of the, because have they ever seen some of the celebrities' kids? I mean, you don't want those kids. I was in Hollywood for a very short time, and I had a chance to meet, you know, or see or be around some very famous celebrities. And they had kids. I mean, now, of course, some have beautiful, some, you know, the actresses have daughters who look like them. And, you know, some of the actors the same. But some of them, I mean, they are just plain, just plain ugly. I would be terrified to combine those genes.
It's true. And genes are not always destiny. And that's another part of the story that I think is really important to get across. And certain people treat it that way, like that it's going to give you some kind of fate. And that's not true for most traits and most diseases either. There are certain ones that are definitely genetically determined with a very high correlation of genes, but most of the complex ones are not. So, of course, it's a combination of nature and nurture, and we shouldn't treat it as fate.
But as we know, the very wealthy in Silicon Valley are doing all sorts of desperate things, trying to figure out how they can live longer. We have this one man who spent, tens of millions of dollars on keeping himself young. We have people who really get these ideas, and it's exactly that. The Silicon Valley guys who are all so smart, they expect that they, you know, what are they going to do? They want smart kids, and then their kids aren't smart. So what? Where does it come down? I mean, tell us about the three characters, and let's see where they fit into the system.
Yeah, so there's three characters whose lives all revolve around aspects of this medical breakthrough. One is Ember. She's a biosecurity guard who's hired by desirable people like celebrities to protect them from any inadvertent loss of their DNA that could be stolen by the black market group and used against them or put up for sale. So she goes on tour with this famous musician as his bioguard, and they end up falling in love. And then there's the character Quinn, who's a surrogate, and she has been hired by a man who's a widow to carry his baby, and she starts to become suspicious of this man, and in fact also of who the other parent is of the baby that she's carrying, and she suspects it might be Thorne, the famous singer, from the other perspective, and she's wondering if she has kind of, without her own knowledge or consent, has she assisted the crime of bringing a non-consensual child into the world with stolen gametes. So she's also one perspective. And then we have the perspective of a third character, Lily, who's an aspiring young journalist, eager to make her name in investigative reporting, and she's looking for the right story. And at the same time at home, her parents, who are a little older, have just told her that they're about to have a child again, especially because now that she's grown up and out of the house, her parents have the time to focus on another baby that they'd always wanted. And now that there's so few biological constraints on parenthood, older people can have children. And of course, they're also living much longer too in this future. So, they have just dropped this bomb on her that she's about to become a sister. So all these three characters are greatly impacted by this new breakthrough, and their lives intersect in very surprising ways.
And when Lee Child says breathless, it is breathless because you're going from one story to another, and the idea, really what Ember is doing and being hired to follow around somebody to protect their DNA, that part of the story I found so interesting because I know right now celebrities have, they actually do, I think, have people who pick up their things and pick up their, I think a few years ago there was some girl tried to sell stars underwear. So they're aware of this problem.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. And of course, the aspiring journalist, perhaps based a little bit on you, because it's so interesting in your career, as a journalist? I know that you started off with the idea of studying writing or at least literature, and you switched over to journalism, and you have made such a mark in journalism with your absolutely wonderful stories, which have been featured in so many places. And I know, of course, the New York Times and Newsweek, and you've been you were very big, I would say, during the COVID period, reporting on COVID. So you have made a remarkable career for your own self. And one of the ones where your stories appeared, which I love, I don't get many people who have been in one of my favorite magazines, which is in Popular Mechanics, because I think Popular Mechanics is so underrated. People don't realize the wonderful stories that are in that magazine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and Popular Mechanics gave me some of my most interesting assignments of my journalism career. I remember I worked on some really fascinating stories about cancer and aging and other topics. Great magazine.
It is. So you bring all of that to this story. Where do you sort of, what shocked you the most to think of when, you know, the whole idea is shocking, but what shocked you the most when you were doing this research? How, you know, the things that might have really, really frightened you?
Well, I think what surprised me is how fast it's progressing. So when I started this idea, it had been published in a scientific journal that it was possible for two mice to conceive through this method of having some cells taken from their tail, turned into sperm and egg, and then healthy mice pups were born. So that really gave me confidence that, hey, this could be something in the future that really happens. But then last year, when the book was already written, another study came out in Nature showing that two male mice had conceived a healthy mouse pup just through this method. And that was quite a shocker, I think. It really shows the potential of this to change paradigms for reproduction.
What? I don't know. You can't fool Mother Nature, or you can't. There's something that, why would people want to do this? I know there are people who will do this. If it was available, I think some of these people would do this. It's sort of, I don't know, it's sort of a nice surprise to see when you have a baby what the baby's going to be.
It's true. And what I find really interesting as a writer and as someone who studied ethics is how our notion of what is acceptable is a moving target. So to us and to many people today, probably the majority of people today, this seems really weird, strange, and unsettling that you could generate embryos this way and then they would be able to be scored based on their DNA and given certain percentages of the likelihood of traits and diseases. However, that first of all is going to be highly desired by parents who want to make sure that their kids are avoiding illness. That's going to be the first application. And it's already happening now. There's a clinic that announced 2 months ago that if you're doing IVF, a couple can pay $2,500 to have their embryos wholly sequenced, which means all the letters of their genetics read and interpreted solely for the sake of understanding their disease risk so that parents can decide which embryo will be the healthiest. Now, no clinics today are offering scores based on traits, right? That's a very highly controversial area. But the fact is that the technology is available today to get that information already. And so I think in another generation or two, the needle will move towards what we think is not acceptable to, is it actually more acceptable to do this than not do it to ensure your child's future well-being?
Will you try to imagine people in the past, if they had this testing and they could do this? Somebody did this with, let's say Einstein. Now, he wasn't the most gorgeous guy in the world, And if somebody was looking at the DNA and they said, oh my gosh, he's going to be born looking like that, well, let's forget this one. I mean, think of what people, you don't know, you know, wonderful, beautiful things can be wrapped in ugly packages. And then ugly packages could be filled with absolutely horrible stuff. So
It's true.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the big takeaways from the story is that no matter how much parents or science could try to control the outcome, the truth is that it's not something you can control. And there's so much outside of our ability to understand completely that it's silly to think, it's almost a folly to think that you can determine whatever your future child will be. So that's a big theme in the story, even though the science has advanced so far.
So like when you do DNA sequencing, they don't know what every little thing is, do they yet?
Of course, it's definitely an evolving science.
So they don't know what made Einstein like that, or what perhaps somebody who was very beautiful, Audrey Hepburn, looked like that. They don't know which sequence was the one. And I'm not sure if there's how many things in DNA. My goodness, it's
so there's 3 billion letters of DNA, or 3.2 billion letters, and there's about 20,000 genes. That make up who we are. So it's quite a ton of information. And as you can imagine, it's all still in the process of being understood. That said, there are now already, you know, well-known correlations of certain genes to intelligence and to characteristics like facial symmetry. So as AI improves along with biology and biotechnology, it's just going to get more and more clear as to how our genes end up contributing to our the way we look and the way we are.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny, people will look at say somebody, a very rich guy, one of these billionaires who soon will have trillionaires, he says, oh well, that actress, I mean, she's just so gorgeous, I just have to have a baby with her. And he goes ahead and steals her lipstick and sequences all of this, and then he finds out that, my gosh, when she was 16, before she entered her first beauty contest, she had a nose job, a lip, and this and that. So he comes out with the ugliest kid you ever saw. I mean,
that's a good twist.
I mean, isn't it? I mean, really, because you don't know what people look like. I mean, they had on the news this guy who, I mean, I thought he was looked very nice as a, you know, his face was fine, but he went through this massive surgery, and he looks like a completely different person and 20 years younger. So you'd think, oh, I want a baby with that one, I'm going to steal his DNA. And then you're like, oh boy, what did I get here?
That sounds like a great spin-off episode if this was ever a series.
Exactly. So you had fun. I think you had fun with the developing the three characters. I'm not sure. I think I sort of gravitated more to Amber Ryan because I like the idea of following somebody around. But also Quinn and Lily. So you had fun with this book, I think. You know,
I did.
You know, as a journalist, of course, the fact that you went into journalism, I think, was great, because I think journalism actually teaches you to be a better writer than taking, writing degree. That's my opinion.
Oh, 100% agree. Yeah, that's why I did journalism, because it was a real world education. And all my assignments in journalism school were to go out and report on things happening out around me in my community, talk to people, and then write it all down concisely and answer all the 5 questions and get the information across on a deadline. Nothing could be a better training for a writer than that.
I agree. It really does make a difference to have this real world experience, to do things, to be out there, to talking to real people, discovering real stories. And you've had such a wide ranging reach into both bioethics and into science in general, which is, I love science. I was a lab technician when I was young, so I love all of that. And I tend to see that so many of the people who go just through writing classes, writing schools, MFAs or whatever, they're regurgitating the stuff that they've read, but they've not met real people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Now, for you, you have been, as I said, in the forefront. And, well, let's just mention your website, because you have, as I said, you have a link there to your articles. And people, really, you should read them, because particularly all of the articles during the COVID, excellent. I mean, just excellent work. And it's just Kira Peacock, but it's spelled, Kira is K-I-R-A, but Peacock is spelled P-E-I-K-O-F-F. And you know how you get a little dyslexic? I kept looking at it and say, Peacock, I'm scared. I kept thinking about apple pie, but it's Peacock, and right? I'm pronouncing it right.
Yes, that's correct. And I know the last name can be hard to remember, so if anyone's interested, you can just Google Baby X Book and you'll find it.
That's it, Baby X Book. It's really fascinating story. It makes you think, it makes you want to be careful, and it makes you wonder if all these people who are, in a way, it's scary when you think everybody is voluntarily and actually paying to send their DNA to people, and you don't know what they're doing with it. So it is a scary new world.
It is, and I've been told it's like a terrifying episode of Black Mirror, which I take as a high compliment.
That is a good comparison, absolutely. So Kira Peacock, it's a fascinating book. It's a timely book. People are thinking about embryos and about DNA, and it's called Baby X, and the cover, I like the cover of Big X, but underneath it says a thriller, and it is a thriller. And it was a joy to talk to you today, Kira.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on the program.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. What an idea. Oh, my gosh. I know two people. Well, I know somebody who's absolutely gorgeous. She's really gorgeous. I mean, really gorgeous. And naturally gorgeous, because I've known her since she was very young. But her parents, and they're my friends, and they will admit, nobody would have expected them to have one of the most beautiful babies in the world. Anyway, everybody, we're going to have a little promo for Jim Lamb and his wonderful book of poetry, An Eclectic Assortment. And then I'll be back with my next guest.
Looking for inspiration? Looking for something that will intrigue you? Then this book is for you. Jim Lamb's poems start out as caterpillars, creepy, crawly, and raw. Then a miracle happens as they transform into colorful, bright, and conspicuous works of art. You can find Jim's new book of poetry, Hurting Butterflies, at Amazon.com. It's the perfect gift for the book lover in your life, even if it's you. Hurting Butterflies, the perfect holiday gift, available on Amazon. Get Hurting Butterflies.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the TAM Talk Radio Network.
and I am back with my next guest, Simon Gidney. And we are going to be talking about a book called Caring for the Caregiver, a 52-week check-in for self-reflection, cultivating gratitude, nurturing well-being, and mastering stress management on your compassionate caregiving journey. I'm so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, Sydney.
Good morning, Patsy. Delighted and honored to join you.
Well, I'm happy to have you here because I like to do a wide range of books to bring to my listeners because I never know which book is going to touch their heart, which book is going to help them through the day, and which book will help them for the rest of their lives. So I was thrilled when you contacted me and I got to look at the book and read the book, but also to look at your website, which is called A Mind to Care. So tell us about the book and about how you got involved in this.
Okay. How I got involved first, probably. I come from a fairly hard-bitten corporate background. I was a corporate attorney by training. Then I went into business. So I spent really my whole working career in the corporate world. Sold my business in 2020 and started this business, A Mind to Care. I fell into it by accident, really. I bumped into a gentleman who had come up with an activity system to help entertain people living with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. He had become ill and he couldn't continue with it, and I was looking for something to do, and I got involved, and I have to say, Patsy, it's completely turned my world upside down. I've been really captivated and consumed by this area of caregiving, you know, and I just think people who care for others who are suffering with these issues or other issues are the unsung heroes of our generation.
Well, it is an important subject as we have so many people who are in some type of care facility, in requiring care, some at home, some in different living conditions. And the journey for a caregiver is a difficult one. It is it's one where you don't always get the recognition you deserve. You have to have a strength that many people just can't do. So what you've done with this book, and I like very much the journal prompts and the writing exercises. Tell us about the weekly planner and how you are encouraging caregivers to really, I think, by doing this kind of thing, not just evaluating their week or what they're doing, but for them to realize the importance of their work.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of professional caregivers, a lot of caregivers who work for care agencies, and those companies that they work for may well offer training and support. The group that we've mainly targeted with this book, Patsy, is the unpaid family caregivers. So that would be a spouse, you know, a husband looking after his wife or vice versa, or a son or daughter looking after a parent. And those people, I mean, estimates vary, but there are somewhere between 50 and 60 million unpaid caregivers in the United States at the moment. And those are regular people who probably never thought that they would be doing this. It's something that life has forced onto them, in a sense that, you know, their love for their loved one is such that they're at home looking after them. And it can feel very isolating. I think numbers vary again, but 70% roughly of caregivers experience anxiety and depression. Sometimes there's a stigma about the fact that they're caring for somebody with living with Alzheimer's, and they can become isolated. And, you know, I think it goes back to anybody who's been on an airplane will be familiar with the instruction that should oxygen masks deploy, you need to make sure you put your own mask on first before you assist anybody else with theirs. And that may seem cold initially, but the logic of it is unassailable. Like, you can only help somebody else if you are in a position to do so. And a lot of family caregivers, because of the stress and the strain that they're under, they neglect their health, they neglect their own well-being, they don't eat properly, they don't go to the doctors. So what we're trying to do is to give them a book that, can just help possibly recenter them, a little mindfulness, tips and things to help them get through the day to basically survive what is a very tough situation that, they found themselves in.
And this is, it's set out as a 52-week journal. And as you said, it's really, I think, helps them to put this down on paper. It makes them think about who they are and why they're doing it. It is a very encouraging process.
Yes, we've kind of mixed in some motivational sayings throughout the book. And then, as you say, it's a self-journal because, you know, I think journaling is widely accepted that if you write things down, you know, it can help to clarify them. And you can helps you to see them clearly and put them in perspective. And then we have each week we'll repeat the same exercises. For example, it may seem a little trite, but we have them tick a box where it says that they remembered to be kind to themselves. They remembered to take a deep breath, to try and laugh a little, to get out into nature, because I think that can have a powerful calming effect, to eat a whole meal. I mean, these things seem basic, but I remember talking to a caregiver once when we launched our, games and activity system with puzzles and, different activities. And she said to me that even if she could find something that would engage her husband's attention for 30 minutes, it would help her, it would give her the time to make a sandwich, make a coffee, put some laundry on. And so, you know, these are important things to just try and center yourself and just take a deep breath and perhaps call a friend for a chat. These are things that can kind of get lost in the day-to-day struggles, you know?
Well, let's talk about the equipment, the tools that you're giving to people, because this is important. When people are so deeply involved in caregiving, there's the stresses of going often to doctors, spending endless hours at, you know, waiting in doctor's offices or just waiting around for things. And then when you're working with the person that you love, the person that you're caring for, if you have activities, it is really fantastic. And you have this website, A Mind to Care, and you have products there, which I found fascinating. So tell us some of this starter system, I think you call it, for products.
Well, I think one of the things that people need to understand about Alzheimer's in particular is that it's a progressive disease. It can start, you know, with very mild symptoms, but unfortunately it progresses and it gets worse over time. So at any given point, people living with Alzheimer's may be at a different point on that curve of progression. So for some people, they may still be able to do crossword puzzles. Other people, an activity or an entertainment would be much simpler, such as even colouring in or, you know, join the dots activities. So what we have is it's essentially a whiteboard. It's a portable whiteboard, and it folds so it can be used flat, stood up as an easel, or you could use it on your lap. It has four sides, each of which is dry erase. So you could draw a tic-tac-toe on that, wipe it off, write notes, wipe it off. It's also magnetic, so you could stick photo frames, magnetic photo holders on there, or other magnetic games or accessories. And we then developed a range of slim magnetic sheets, which are also magnetic and dry erase. So, for example, a weekly planner. We have others that are designed for people who are not able to communicate verbally. So there are images of conditions such as I'm hungry or I'm thirsty that they can point to. These sheets can be put on the board and then taken off or wiped clean. So that was kind of the centerpiece. But we're adding new things all of the time. We've just added some flashcards with different images on because, as we say in one section of the book, sometimes they're a good way to initiate a conversation. You know, you show a photograph of something, a picture of something, and you can ask, oh, do you remember this? Do you know what it is? And that can lead into other conversations. So we're constantly adding new things around that core product offering, Patsy.
Well, I think it's so important because when you are taking care of somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia, having things to work with, because they need tactile things. It's so important to keep them active, whether it's looking at cards, as you said, at flashcards. All of this helps to stimulate them. And when somebody is doing this weekly planner, I just want to encourage people to do this because the reason for journaling is to keep a record. Because you forget, you know, what you've done and when you've done it, and the little insights that you sometimes get, a simple word. When you're dealing with people whose memories are sometimes, the present isn't as clear to them, but the past is, this is very exciting when you're talking to somebody who can talk to you about their past. And to keep notes, to keep a record, because once, you know, at some point, perhaps as a caregiver, you yourself want to write a book. It doesn't have to, you know, be a bestseller, but you can do a family memoir, perhaps, or a memoir that will help people understand what you've gone through and to help them learn something about the process that they've gone through. So I think this weekly planner idea is brilliant.
Thank you. I mean, you make a couple of very, very valid points there because one of the reasons as well why it's important to try and keep people engaged is that if they sleep all day, then they will be awake all night. And that is just terrible for the caregiver because the caregiver is obviously awake during the day and then is not able to sleep at night. So that's another very important reason why, you know, if you can engage the person you're looking after in activities, and we have a number of them in the book, it's very, very important. To your second point, Patsy, I read a wonderful book, which you may be familiar with, written by Patty Davis, the daughter of Ronald Reagan, called Floating in the Deep End. And she wrote about her experiences as she watched her father struggle with and eventually succumb to Alzheimer's. So, I completely agree. I think the more we write things down, the more we recognize things, that I think the more it helps us to deal with them.
You're right. And I do want to encourage people to get this, if you have, and when we say, you know, so many millions, 50 million, 60 million people are caregivers, and some are... Yeah. At so the beginning of the process where somebody's just starting with symptoms, and right then, the minute you notice somebody with symptoms, this is the time that you should start doing this. This is the time you should start doing all of this this, I wouldn't call it training, but this sort of process of keeping them active, keeping their minds active. You know, it's a sad thing, but one of the things that I think is so important, people, when you recognize and you start recognizing some symptoms, this is a time that you jump in as a caregiver. Yes. Start caring really early on. Don't wait until it's progressed so far. The earlier you catch these things, the more stimulation you give to people at an early stage to sort of ward off the worst parts that will come eventually. That's important.
If I could say one other thing, Patsy, for anybody listening who might know someone who is a caregiver, someone who's caring for a family member, just make time, give them a call, just to check in, see how they're doing, see if, you know, they want you to bring them a Starbucks in, or tell them you're going to the grocery store, or are there a few things you can get for them? Because I think the power, we have no idea how impactful it is if we give somebody a word of encouragement. It just for them to know that they're not on their own, they're not isolated, there are people who are thinking about them and who care for them, it can have an amazing impact. I was at a senior fair last year, and a lady came up to me who had lost her husband a year before to Alzheimer's, and she had cared for him. And she came up to me and she said, "Oh, I wish I'd seen this before my husband died. He would have enjoyed it." And she started to cry, and I put my arm around her, and I found myself crying as well. So I was there in this senior fair with my arms around this lady, and we were both weeping. And the old corporate voice in the back of my head was saying, "What on earth are you doing?" But the more you become involved in this, and you realize how much people are going through, and you realize just to be able to talk to somebody, hug somebody, just to know that you're not on your own, you know, it has a powerful, powerful impact on people who really need it.
And there are three very important words here. Encourage the caregiver. Really, what you said, call them up, be in contact, let them know that you appreciate what they're doing for the person that they love, but also to engage. And if you can, if you just, sometimes it's a little thing that you can do, perhaps send them a book. It's so much fun, both for the caregiver and for perhaps somebody at the early stages to get a package, to open a package and say, "Whoa, that's nice. That was another book, just a book perhaps about nature, a book about trees, a book about poems, just something nice," so that the caregiver knows that somebody is thinking about them. And then if you can do something really sweet, like if you give a gift certificate for a manicure, or even a half day at a spa for a caregiver, that is something that is something that will last a year. Somebody will be so thrilled by that, because caregivers, as you said, they neglect themselves so often. They don't do, they don't take care of themselves. So for them to get a certificate to go and have just a free manicure, which you might think is not a big deal, but it is for somebody who has been, sort of tied to the home or tied to, a person who that they can't leave very often. But when they can, to have a special treat, and that's where you have to encourage, engage, and then help them to enjoy life in whatever way you can.
Yeah, I could not agree more, and I think you're absolutely right. The impact of something like that is far, far greater than we would imagine when we're doing it. So I completely agree with that, Pastor.
And when you think of people who have Alzheimer's, they do relate very much to books. I've known a few of my friends who have are caregivers, and they're in one case, her father, he loves when she, you know, says, I do a lot of reviews for National Geographic. So I do a lot of their wonderful books about animals. And yep. I discovered how much he loved books about animals. And so I had given her one of the books that I got from Nat Geo, because they send me a lot of books. And she said her father just spent hours. You know, the yep. pages in Nat Geo books are top quality. They're nice. They're thick. They're easy to turn. And he would spend hours looking at the animals and laughing sometimes, because it was a book about mothers and babies, animals. And yes. he would laugh. And she said, well, he never laughs. And he would laugh yeah. at something as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating subject, because you know all of the research is going into pharmaceutical solutions, but you know there are a number of things that seem to cut through the fog of Alzheimer's. You know, books and pictures. You mentioned tactile. That's another one. I mean, music is another that can cut through the fog of, and somebody who is really struggling with it. They hear a familiar piece of music, they come to life, you know. It's a very, very interesting subject, actually, how we can still reach people living with Alzheimer's through their senses. Very, very interesting area for research, I would hope.
Well, Simon Gidney, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you, and I want people to check out your website, Mind to Care. And if you have anyone in your family that you're taking care of, or you know somebody who is taking care of, please check out this and check out the book. It's available on Amazon, and it is called Caring for the Caregivers, a 52-week check-in. And it's a journal, and it's wonderful. It's the beautifully illustrated. Again, Simon, thank you so much for joining me.
Patsy, thank you for the opportunity. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Wow. What a book. It is available, and please, it's on Amazon. If you know anybody who is a caregiver, get this book and send it to them today. They will appreciate it. It will help them. And again, for all caregivers out there, if you're a caregiver, take the opportunity to start keeping these notes, these journal writings, and one day you'll sit down and you will write what I call, it's becoming very popular, micro memoirs. And micro memoirs are a fascinating way to tell your story about what you've done and to really keep your mind going, because it's something very important. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because I like to say something nice to him. I'd say something nice every day because he is so great. And everybody, please, please think about who you can say something nice to. Encourage, engage, and enjoy. And get out there in nature and read a book under a tree today. And because it's going to be a lovely day. Well, this is a lovely day here. But wherever you are, read a good book and have a wonderful, wonderful day. And I think also I have to say special hello to Carol J. Perry. Carol, I am so proud of you and your new book.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.